The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Zach and I have both been annoyed by a tendency in these sorts of conversations to conflate liberal democracy and democracy, or liberalism and democracy. We think of democracy as the kind of hardware, and liberalism is the software that you can run on it, right? Democracy is simply free expression and its consequences. And those consequences can run the gamut from fascism to, you know, the most platonic ideal of a liberal democracy you can imagine. And liberalism is a culture of norms and practices and institutions that check it, that funnel it in directions that I think most of us would prefer.
I'm Alan Rosenstein, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, July 11th, 2022. We often use the terms democracy and liberal democracy interchangeably, but they're not the same thing. Democracy means majority rule and public participation. Liberal democracy means democracy plus minority rights. There's no guarantee that democracy will be liberal. And in fact, some of the same things that enable democracy can also undermine its liberal commitments. Zach Gershberg, a professor of journalism and media studies at Idaho State University, and Sean Illing, host of the Vox Conversations podcast, have recently released a new book, The Paradox of Democracy: Free Speech, Open Media, and Perilous Persuasion. In the book, they argue that every democracy is fundamentally shaped by the dominant media technology of its time, and that the current landscape of social media and cable news fuels our democracy, but also pushes it in an illiberal, authoritarian direction. I spoke with Zach and Sean about how American democracy got to this point, how the present compares to the past, and what, if anything, can be done to put liberal democracy on firmer footing. It's the Lawfare Podcast, July 11th. Zach Gershberg and Sean Illing on the paradox of democracy.
So I want to start by asking how you two came to write this book and how your thinking in particular has evolved given the events of the past several years. You know, we've had two Trump impeachments, January 6th, Trump's deplatforming from social media, the Biden administration's attempt, whether successful or not, we'll see, to bring us back to some normality. You know, how has that all shaped how you've thought about this project?
I don't know, Zach, you want to tell the origin story there?
I can, but it started with Sean coming out for a visit and going on a hike where we were seemingly tracked by a mountain lion. But we had some pretty serious philosophical differences about politics, communications, things like that. But we sort of talked through kind of different approaches to thinking about society and politics, and sort of started discussing an idea is like, what if we sort of mash these all up together, combining law, theory, philosophy, media studies, and those sorts of things.
You know, the interesting thing, and this was, Zach, I came out there to give that talk at Idaho State, and this was a few months before Trump's election, right? So it was like October, September 2016. And I was thinking about writing a book. I was doing a lot of pieces sort of in the vein of like, you know, the democracy is dying, that whole thing. And I was pretty convinced that it was, and maybe it still is, but I was very much kind of captive to the mood of the moment. And then I got out there and I talked to Zach, and I didn't know who Marshall McLuhan was. I mean, I heard his name before, but I'd never read anything that he wrote. I'd never heard of Neil Postman. I just didn't know much about, I didn't think much about media and the history of media and how it is interacted with politics, really going all the way back to ancient Greece. And so Zach sort of opened up my mind to that, and we sort of found a way to blend my political theory with his knowledge of media theory and media history, and yada yada yada, we have a book.
So let's talk about the book. So I'm going to oversimplify enormously here, but I see your book as making two important points, related but separate. The first point is that although we talk about liberal democracy as if it's a single thing, the two ideas, liberalism and democracy, don't actually have that much to do with one another. And then the second and related point your book is making is that the thing that connects those two, brings them together, liberalism and democracy, and sometimes pushes them apart, is media. And that's why you say, I think near the beginning of your book, that media ecology is the master political science. I mean, is that a fair summary of the things you're trying to get across in this work?
Yeah, no, it may be a bit of it may be a bit of a stretch to say that media ecology is a master political science. I mean, something we took pains to do here in this book is we're not trying to say that we've cracked the code here. We're not trying to say that here is the definitive way to think about, to understand, to model democracy. We're saying this is a very important way to see it and conceptualize it. And it's a way that has been under-theorized and underappreciated. So we're going to try to fill that hole here. And, you know, I think Zach and I have both been annoyed by a tendency in these sorts of conversations to conflate liberal democracy and democracy, or liberalism and democracy. We think of democracy as the kind of hardware, and liberalism is the software that you can run on it, right? Democracy is simply free expression and its consequences. And those consequences can be, can run the gamut from fascism to, you know, the most platonic ideal of a liberal democracy you can imagine. And liberalism is a culture of norms and practices and institutions that check it, that funnel it in directions that I think most of us would prefer. But it is not democracy as such. And to fail to see that, I think, is a terrible mistake. And that's something that I think happens a lot in the discourse and in some of the literature on democracy.
Zach, you're the media theorist. So do you want to pick up the mantle of media studies being the master political science? Was that a line you wrote?
No, it's actually one of Sean's lines. So it's kind of funny, but in some ways, this was not necessarily the book we thought we were going to be writing. We thought we were going to be writing a sort of, well, I would say something that's become pretty standard, you know, democracy's dying and here's the seven things we need to do to save it. And as we got into the history and looking at all of it, we're like, no, actually we're heading towards a place, especially during the Trump years and everything going on, where we're returning to what democracy actually looks like. And so the variables that kept leaping out at us when we looked at Democratic Athens or the Roman Republic or the early American states, as well as the French Revolution, and then on to the 20th century and 21st, is that the sense of free expression, but then also how media, the overall communications environment, influences that in ways that, and Alan, I really do like how you put that, that in some ways, because we think it's very important that we distinguish democracy as such from liberal democracy. And in some ways, we keep seeing, I think, the media environment pushing those two things apart. And liberal democracy is just one sort of, it's now just kind of one party or platform within which democracy can work, but it's by no means inevitable. And I think we have spent too far a time just assuming those norms and institutions of liberalism just go hand in hand with democracy.
Yeah, I think the way we put it in the book is to say that liberalism is one exit along the democratic highway, but it is just an exit. There are others, most of which are less desirable.
So let me stand up for the idea that there's something special about liberal democracy as a coherent unit, right? Because I think you're totally right. And it's just historically, it's pretty clear that there are many exits, as you put it, to democracy. But it does seem that the only exit, quote unquote, that allows a democracy to stay a democracy is liberal democracy, right? Like you can't, you know, democracy can end in fascism, but you can't have a fascist democracy, or at least not after the first election that establishes it. So, you know, if, for the defenders of liberal democracy as a kind of coherent whole, isn't there a way in which, like, there actually is something special about liberalism's connection to democracy that is not true for fascism or totalitarianism or, you know, kleptocracy or whatnot?
I would say that's true, I think, largely, right? I think liberalism is a way of preserving democracy, right? But it is contingent, right? And you can lose that, you know? And that's the thing I think a lot of people don't quite appreciate fully, right? I mean, the kind of democracy we all want to live in, I think, is ensured and preserved and reinforced through the values and the institutions of liberalism. But if you lose that, you're left with just the blank slate that is democracy, which is just a wide open culture of open communication. And that is a very unpredictable, unwieldy thing. And to take liberalism for granted, to assume that it is democracy as such and not a way of funneling and preserving democracy, I think is a terrible mistake.
I think also we're not trying, because the back half of the book is all about how the age of liberal democracy triumphed and then the age of liberal democracy died. But it's this isn't, you know, Sean and I running on the beach bare-chested and, you know, doing the Rocky, you know, hug in the splashing water and cheering on its demise.
I'd watch that.
You're the only one, my friend.
This is a family podcast, I thought.
Now, that's a Patreon exclusive, everyone.
So, I mean, there is something melancholic, I think. And you can see this reflected sometimes in you know, coverage, like on CNN. They so desperately want a Watergate moment where these moments will matter and save us and the institutions will stand up, and they keep even asking for it. Like, was this, I mean, it's all very meta. They keep asking John Dean, was this the John Dean moment? And I just think it's remarkable. We desperately want that, but it's gone. And now liberal democracy endures as one, a sort of one party battling with others. The norms can no longer be taken for granted.
A thought I had while reading this book is, you know, given, and again, I agree with this, that democracy does not imply liberalism and it can often lead to some very bad exits. Is it democracy that we should be so concerned about? Maybe what we should be concerned about is liberalism. And to the extent that democracy helps us get there, that's great. But ultimately, it's not the democracy thing we should care about. It's whatever system gets us liberalism, right? And, you know, I wonder if you disagree with that. Is it because you think that, well, as a practical matter, not only is liberalism the best way to preserve democracy, but democracy is the best way to preserve liberalism? Like, you know, a benevolent autocracy does not usually stay benevolent for very long. Or do you think there's something actually inherently valuable about democracy over and above the fact that historically speaking, it has tended or has been the best way to get to liberalism?
Yeah, I mean, we say pretty explicitly in the book that we are pro-democracy, right? That democracy, for all its faults and contradictions and paradoxes, still remains the best form of political life. And it remains the best form of political life because it affords the possibility of free expression and the ability to check power, right? That is its claim to superiority over every other form of political life. And every other form of political life is almost certain to degenerate into some kind of tyranny, or it's almost tyranny by definition. Democracy can go that way, but it doesn't have to. And that's why we kind of rope in this existentialist dimension of democracy, because it really does turn on its citizens and the decisions they make or don't make and how they come to make those decisions, which again is in large part a function of the media ecology, at least in our minds.
So do you think that, for example, the idea of a liberal autocracy is coherent. So I know Singapore is always the example that comes to mind, right? And we can argue about how autocratic it is, but like, it's not exactly a democracy, but it seems like an okay place. I've been there. You know, the night markets are delicious. People seem pretty happy. Do you think that the problem with a Singapore is that it's just not going to stay liberal forever, or it's not liberal? Like, it doesn't matter how quote unquote free the people feel they are. They're just not free because they don't live in a democracy.
Yeah, no, I think and it's interesting that Singapore functions as a city state in some ways. I mean, that obviously is a sort of challenge. And I think we sort of close the book on this note is like, we have a choice to prefer the comfort or security of the illusion of Singapore. But I mean, contrast Singapore with all these other sort of wannabe authoritarians promising security. And I think the frustrating thing about democracy that we really try to communicate in the book, Sean was just sort of going over with those two things, is the opportunities for free expression and the opportunities to provide a check on power. Those are obviously just opportunities. And sometimes those opportunities are squandered or exploited. And why we sort of are somewhat critical of liberal democracy is we see it as it has papered over both the opportunities and limitations of democracy. And now we're all left without any sense of why we face what we face. But I think that's a challenge. We say if people want to walk through that door of preferring an authoritarian sort of model that may provide security and liberal values, perhaps that's what they should go for. But we also have been, I think we try to plant our flag that even though we're complicating the picture of democracy, we're also there and ready for it.
Yeah, I think we even say this in the book, right? Like I would tell the Grand Inquisitor to go fuck himself, right? Like I would always 10 times out of 10 choose the chaos and the uncertainty of freedom over the stability of slavery, over the illusion of security that you may get in some kind of authoritarian state. Because in an authoritarian state, the ability of the human person to express him and herself freely and openly is not available. And that is not a world worth living in. But if you do want to live in a free world, you do want to open up society, that entails a lot of risk and it entails commitments. Right. And whether or not society is able to do those things turns on a lot of different factors, but it is not guaranteed. It is not certain. It is a question mark in lots of ways. It is a ongoing perpetual experiment that is unfinishable by definition. And that is the burden of democracy. I think it is absolutely worth pushing that boulder up that hill over and over and over again, or keeping it from rolling back down to the ground. But it is hard. It is hard, no doubt.
So I want to go to where the boulder starts rolling historically. And Zach, since you mentioned the fact that Singapore is a city state, I mean, this all starts with city states. Obviously, this starts with Athens. And that's how sort of you open your book. And one thing I really appreciate about it is, and most of the book is actually history of how this tension plays out and how it's mediated by media technology as that, you know, advances from the oral tradition to, you know, whatever the hell TikTok is. You know, and we've had this tension since the very beginning, since ancient Athens. And so I'd love to hear you both say more about how the ancient Greeks thought about democracy, the idea of free speech versus free participation, you know, the influence of that thought on the kind of, you know, Western / modern tradition that we find ourselves in. And you know, ultimately, do you think that these debates that we're still having, it's all just kind of footnotes on Socrates' execution? Like this is all this is about. We're just replaying this over and over and over again in a variety of different cultural and technological, you know, formations.
So the one thing I find kind of fascinating, because we certainly play up, right, Socrates' trial in execution, but actually something in our look at classical democracy and rhetoric and all those sorts of things is how this, you know, the term isagoria becomes really important in Athens, this notion of free and equal speech by citizens in the assembly. But the important thing is we always remember Socrates, but there is a continual practice of ostracism in Athens where politicians are sent away for years and then come back, and And, you know, Socrates chose, you know, I guess the hemlock after his trial went awry. But, you know, Aristotle was ostracized. There were sophists on the other side of Socrates who were ostracized and had to leave. And so it is kind of, as we, you know, seem to have all this anxiety about democracy in the here and now, right? You know, a coup attempt, cancel culture, all these sorts of things coming to a head. I don't know, there's always been this impulse to say, well, we weren't like Athens, we were more like Rome, which I think we say in the book was somehow even worse. But you know, but I think it's just interesting that we're using different terms for the anxieties we're experiencing, but these were sort of baked in, even though the media environment, the communications environment was different, but we were still using persuasion and personal animus in bad ways.
Yeah, I mean, it's not exactly a hot take, but I mean, I think Plato really was an it-getter, right? And even though in the end we have to depart from him because he didn't believe in democracy, he really didn't. He thought it was chaos and that it would degenerate into herd hysteria. And so he preferred this, you know, the philosopher king, which is just, you know, kind of fantasy land nonsense. But to his credit, I think he was right in understanding the power of rhetoric, right? Like watching the birth of sophistry, like watching how when you open up society to the persuasive powers of demagogues and bad faith actors and bullshit artists, that can go very, very badly. He wasn't wrong about that, you know? And the question is, you know, is that a reason to reject democracy, or is it just a challenge that has to be managed and addressed? And we think it's the latter, but it is a challenge. Like, he wasn't exactly wrong about that. You know, I think that's pretty clear. I think history has borne that out.
So, like I said, there's a lot of really good history in this book, and I really encourage the readers to you know, if they can read it, if only for that. Though there's much more in the book, obviously, than that. I want to sort of skip over some of the history, but I do kind of want to then kind of fast forward then to, I think, a particularly interesting moment in the story that you tell, which is sort of the 1930s, right, the rise of fascism. Because one thing that I found striking, and something I actually didn't see discussed in the book, and I'm sort of curious what you think about it, is the idea of what's sometimes called militant democracy or defensive democracy. You know, the idea that we don't just have to choose between, on the one hand, a wide open democracy that allows anti-democratic forces to rise up and take advantage of it, or on the other hand, just not having a democracy at all. So the term militant democracy comes from the German-American political philosopher Karl Lowenstein, who had fled from Germany in 1933 and then came to America in 1937, coined the idea of militant democracy to refer to ways in which democracies can take limited anti-democratic measures to defend themselves, right? Something that Weimar did not do, but that the post-war German constitution allows for. You can't advocate for Nazism in Germany, and if you're a political candidate or you're a political party, you can be banned from the political process on that basis. And in America, we don't quite have the same level of this because we have a First Amendment and a different historical culture, but we have versions of this. I mean, Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, which has gotten a lot of play, obviously, in the wake of January 6th, prohibits politicians who have engaged in insurrection from being in the political process. That's a kind of militant democracy. So are you skeptical that can get you out, can help us escape the kind of tension, the paradox, right? The whole point of your book, that democracy by its very nature cannot effectively fight against anti-democratic forces.
So this is a really great question. And I think it speaks to something Alexis de Tocqueville gets to. And you're right, this notion of militant democracy. And I think in every country, in every democracy, it can play out differently, but the law can be used to support democracy, but oftentimes it can be used as a constraint on democracy. I mean, one of the things we point out in Weimar, there were sort of emergency checks on civil liberties that could be exercised. And even before the Nazi Party took over, these were invoked at certain times. And I think in some ways, militant democracy, liberal democracy, there are ways, there's always these ideas that, okay, we can try to paper over so we don't have an explosion of dangerous rhetoric. But ultimately, And whether it's Germany or another country where everything seems to be lovely, or even, looking at our history in the 21st century from the perspective of say, the 1990s, is that, ultimately we are at the behest of rhetorical choices, whether it's from demagogic politicians or Supreme Court justices or attorneys general. And so those choices do get made, and you never know how it's going to turn out is what I guess is what I'm suggesting.
Yeah. The law is a clumsy construct, and it's as good or bad as the individuals that make it up. I think if we've learned nothing in the last 4 or 5 years, is that the law is quite malleable, and our institutions are quite malleable and quite contingent. And if they become occupied by people who aren't invested in them, they will go away. And the floor can drop out rather quickly. And I think that's one of the many disturbing lessons of this, this era, as it were.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. Want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers, and that the one with the most information about me was called HLEC. I have no idea what HLEC is. So the other day, I got my latest report, and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there, and these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed.
And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code lawfare20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/lawfare20, code lawfare20.
And as a law professor, I will have to admit that you are right. The law is a messy, malleable thing. So we've talked, I think, now a little bit about the first major argument of the book, the relationship, sometimes cooperative, sometimes antagonistic, between liberalism and democracy. I want to turn to the media side. And obviously we've had different forms of media. And again, the history of that is really interesting in the book. But I want to start and focus on the post-war American story, because there, with the rise of television, I think we see the birth of what we have today as our media environment, though obviously it's changed. You have this wonderful description of how TV first saved Richard Nixon's career, the famous Checkers speech. Then it hurt him in the 1960 election because JFK was more telegenic. And then again, it did not do him any favors with Watergate. So I'd love to hear from you all about how you think TV changed democracy. And then also, how did it lose its central place? You know, obviously, we still have TV. Obviously, cable news in particular is really important. Fox News is really important. But maybe I spend too much time on Twitter and I don't have a cable subscription, right? I just watch Netflix. It seems to me, at least, the vibe is that even if a bunch of people are still watching TV, somehow social media is more important. I'm curious if you agree with that. And if so, what supplanted? You know, why did TV lose its dominance?
Well, I think Zach can better speak to how TV changed politics, but I would push back on this. And we were actually just talking about this the other day, yesterday, actually. There's a lot of talk about the digital revolution and social media and how that's changed everything. And in some ways it has, but we are still absolutely positively living in the world that TV and radio built. And I could make the case that TV and radio are still more important than Twitter and TikTok and Instagram. Will that be the case in 5-10 years? I don't know. We're in this period of convergence where digital tech is converging with TV and radio and these other forms of media, and it's scrambling the environment in ways that I don't even think we understand yet. Like, we don't even have, we're transitioning to a new period that does not even have a name yet. I don't think we've even begun to understand how digital is actually changing us, what it means to be human, and how we interact in the world and relate to the world. We're just at the beginning of this. But we're still very much in the age of TV. And the January 6th hearings are like a very clear example of that. But I'll let Zach take it from there.
Right. Well, television, I think, was enormously important in facilitating this notion of the image or the moment. And so for Nixon, it's saving himself with the Checkers speech, losing the 1960 election next to Kennedy, and then having the ad executives, including a young enterprising producer by the name of Roger Ailes, play a huge role in 1968 in the famous book about the Nixon campaign of 68. It's like they wanted the atmosphere of the Astrodome, you know, where the wind never blows, there's never an errant bounce. And then obviously the disaster for Watergate is truly him saying, "I'm not a crook," you know, and it's like, well, you gave it away again. And then he rehabilitates himself as a statesman at the end of his life as well. So it's a good through line. But I think the rhythms of television continue with us, even if people are cutting the cord. And I think what Sean's referring to is we are not in a fully digital age yet. I think we put at the end of the book that this is a sort of event horizon beyond which we can see. I mean, in you're seeing a sort of not just pushback, but you know, TikTok is using video. But then also it's interesting that Netflix, you know, the great disruptor, is like, oh yeah, we may have to use ads. And it's like, oh, you're rediscovering television, are you? Cool. You know, so I mean, you know, I am curious how this plays out. And I do think that there's a sense to which, even though we're extolling the power of TV and the image right now, we also sort of concluded a moment during 2020, you know, for President Trump. He got everything that he wanted, a daily press conference while the country was locked down. All eyes were on him, you know, a sort of provocative debate performance, a photo op, you know, clearing protesters, another op as he recovered from COVID. These were supposed to be the RNC speech at the White House. These were supposed to be great moments in TV history for the presidential image. And they sort of fell flat. So I am curious in what sense, not just the power of television, but the power of the image could be waning.
I mean, I don't think, Alan, I'm curious, would you even disagree with this? Because I don't think it's an overstatement to say, like a lot of people talk about Trump and Twitter, right? Like how he was an early adopter of Twitter and he probably doesn't win the presidency without Twitter. Maybe that's true. Maybe it's not. I don't know who can say. But I don't think there's any doubt that Trump is not president of the United States without The Apprentice. I think that's the case, right? If he doesn't do that television show, if that doesn't establish his brand and his image in the way that it did, is he even competitive? Is he even allowed to run for president when he does? I don't think so. I don't.
No, I think that's right. And here, I mean, I do agree with you, Sean, that we are entering in this sort of convergence of TV and then social media in ways that I think are more of an acceleration, frankly, than a supplantation. And there's a sentence in the book. I don't think you guys go too much into it, maybe because I don't know, it freaked me out. Maybe you were too freaked out to consider the implications of it, which is, you know, when you know, OpenAI gets super intelligent and then takes control over social media algorithms. I mean, are we over? Is it done? I mean, that is a total singularity of media studies, right? It is a scary thought. And you wrote just enough to freak the reader out.
Because I don't have any, I mean, I don't know what else to say, right? We simply have no idea what is on the other side of that, right? If people think we're in some kind of post-truth world now, if people think reality has been carved up and fragmented and scrambled now, holy shit, right? Imagine when deep fakes are truly like indiscernible from real clips. I mean, no one knows what that world is going to look like, and it is impossible to predict how it will change our politics, but there's no doubt it will.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm curious also to then get your thoughts on how we should think about the essence, such as it is, of a particular media technology. I mean, obviously, your book relies, as literally every book should rely, that's thinking about media on Marshall McLuhan. And I've read some Marshall McLuhan. Most importantly, I've seen Annie Hall, so I feel like I'm an expert in his thought. It's a great scene. Yeah. Right. And so, you know, the famous phrase, the medium is the message, articulates this idea that the format of the media in some sense determines what you can say, and particularly the emotional valence. There's hot media, there's cold media, right? There's media that's about a breath over time versus media that's about, you know, breath over space. And obviously TV is the kind of quintessential, well, I forget if he calls it a hot media or cold media, but it's certainly media that kind of overpowers the viewer, I think, and flattens cognition. And yet, Sean, you brought up the January 6th hearings, and I wanted to ask you about that. I've been watching the January 6th hearings, and I've been amazed at the sobriety, the seriousness of it. I mean, this to me shows that TV can be an amazing force for good, especially if you compare it to the sort of hot takes of Twitter. So I'm curious how you see a particular media affect democratic discourse especially in relation to sort of other, maybe even worse alternatives.
Yeah, I mean, Zach could probably speak to immediate ecology better than I can, but I mean, I think all we're really trying to say is that, you know, look, we invent our technological tools and we invariably and in different ways become the tools of those tools. And because media is so fundamental to how we structure our world, to how we relate to it and other people, to the narratives that impose order on our reality, our tools of communication are absolutely transformative and foundational. They color our perceptions and our feelings and our thoughts, whether we know it or not. And, you know, Neil Postman, one of the prominent media ecologists, some people think he was the first to use the term, his book, Amusing Ourselves to Death, I cannot recommend highly enough. But, you know, he says a medium is a technology within which a culture grows, and it gives shape to a culture's politics and social life and ways of thinking. You know, like Zach and I don't think are hard technological determinist, right? Like, I think human life is too complicated for that. But I am a kind of soft determinist in the sense that I do think technology is a primary driver of change. Maybe not the sole driver, but a prominent driver. And to think about the January 6th hearings, right? Like, what's so interesting is that, like, as I was just saying, I still think we live in the political world built by radio and television. But the digital revolution and the political economy of the news business has splintered everything, right? And so you have the Democrats staging this TV spectacle, right? And I think they even brought in like the former head of like ABC News or something like that to like direct, like literally like direct like the primetime hearing the other night. But the thing about it is that even though it is a kind of TV show, it is still very liberal democratic in its operation, right? It's this like measured, deliberative affair designed to make a methodical case against Trump and his Republican enablers. But a massive chunk of the country isn't watching, isn't hearing it. And they inhabit a media ecosystem in which this isn't really happening, or it's happening, but it's a complete sham, right? Like, I don't know if you read that the profile of Steve Bannon by Jennifer Senior in The Atlantic a couple of weeks ago, but it's like, you know, you've got Steve Bannon in there, you know, quoted saying, we're going to shove democracy up the libs' asses, you know.
He's a very eloquent man.
Yeah. And you've got, I'm watching Jake Tapper on CNN the other night interviewing John Dean, right, doing his best impression of a 20th century newsman, you know, pining for the Watergate moment, but it ain't happening. It isn't possible. And this kind of nostalgia for this bygone era, right, where we live in some kind of monoculture where everyone's like watching like three news channels, the same show, the same story of reality, that is gone, man. It is gone.
Well, what strikes me as interesting is I think there's value for congressional hearings to establish a sort of, I guess, a forensic record of how these things happened. But it's all predicated. I just keep seeing was this the smoking gun? Was this the Watergate moment? Was this like there's this desire or hope that we're going to have this moment where everything clicks? And I guess for me, and again, like, you may know legally what they're doing here, because, and I find it kind of interesting, is it's like almost as though Congress is putting together this TV pseudo event to convince the Department of Justice to charge Trump with maybe fraud, maybe sedition, maybe. And so it strikes me as sort of interesting as they haven't clarified what they want, but this is all being staged to sort of, is it to influence the public or to inspire something from DOJ? And so in either case, I think you're dealing with such a fragmented environment that the utility of the hearings also get sort of spun around in this laundry machine of our culture.
Yeah, I will say a lot of the Lawfare daily Slack traffic is trying to figure out what it is the January 6th committee is trying to do at a strategic level.
Yeah, I mean, look, you have a lot of pundits saying none of this will matter. What the hell are we even doing it for? Even Democrats, prominent Democrats, are sort of conceding that. And then you have a lot of pundits. I just read a piece by Jennifer Rubin in the Washington Post, you know, countering in a very sentimental way with lots of platitudes about, of course, it matters. It matters for precedent. It matters for the rule of law, these sorts of things. And okay, I don't disagree with that. Sure. The hearings should happen. I'm glad they're happening. But I think millions of Americans do not give a shit. And I think 35, 40% of the country doesn't have any real abstract commitment to these liberal values, right? These conversations are, you know, one of the reasons why we think that the age of liberal democracy is over. Not that liberal democracy is over. That's not even possible, right? But we've lived in this kind of post-war media environment that was sort of managed by gatekeepers, and the amount of stories a society was able to tell about itself was fairly bounded, right? There was only so many sources of information. But now the world has been shattered into a billion trillion pieces, and it's choose your own adventure now, right? And I think we're learning that a lot of people don't really give a shit about liberalism, and they're playing a game, right? A game that television and the news businesses has helped engineer, and they just want their team to win. And that's it. You know,
I mean, and that's okay too. I mean, there's a sense to which, you know, we continually talk about polarization as a pathology. And I think we see negative effects and problems that arise by it. But from the standpoint of democracy, as we've tried to go through it, you would naturally expect the public to become polarized and to actually care about what they care about and break out into teams and tribes. And so at any rate, I think sometimes our language about where we are is sometimes there's a default because it's counter to this monocultural sense of consensus that was so thoroughly tied up with the age of liberal democracy. Now we don't have that anymore. But that's also just where we find ourselves.
So your book is, I think, primarily diagnostic, I think is a fair way to put it. And I think this last point that both of you made, that it's not that liberal democracy is over, it's that the age of liberal democracy is over. It's the media landscape, the media ecology that made liberal democracy the only game in town. That's what's over. And I think that's a really, really nice way, I think, of summarizing kind of one of the main sets of your book. And although it is primarily a diagnostic, you do suggest at the end, like, some ideas for reform. You know, you talk about the importance of refunding local news, which I think there's general broad consensus. You talk about the importance of media and civic education. I'll admit I've always been a little skeptical when people call for, you know, more civic education, but it probably can't hurt. I am curious what you think about sort of another related policy issue that I spend a lot of time thinking about as someone who thinks about, you know, technology companies and regulation, which is, you know, whether or not technology companies should have a totally free hand in how they structure the digital public space. And so, you know, for example, there are these laws coming out of Texas and Florida that purport to limit the sorts of moderation that companies can do. And these laws are not, I think, good faith attempts to preserve democratic culture. They're pretty obviously kind of bad faith Republican posturing. And I think they've been rejected by sort of everyone as such. But I do think they're getting at something, which is that, look, in a world in which you have these companies that control the digital public space, the people should have some say beyond just the market mechanism of how that digital public space looks. And although maybe the only thing scarier than Facebook controlling how we talk is the government controlling how Facebook controls how we talk, it does seem that this current laissez-faire state of affairs, where everything is just driven by Instagram's desires for more clicks and engagement, quote unquote, is unsustainable. And so I'm curious if you think that we just need to come back to sort of more aggressive governmental regulation of the media ecology.
You know, this is somewhere where I think I just have to be honest and say, I don't know. I really don't know. I'm way out of my depth here. You know, I don't, I mean, you know the law way better than I do. I am not comfortable with Mark Zuckerberg or the good folks at Twitter or Facebook, you know, managing the discourse and deciding what is and isn't permitted. I'm also not comfortable with the government doing that either. I mean, I think this is why we keep coming back to the paradox. right? By definition, it is inescapable. Like, a simply the idea that we can use the law or institutions or technologies to avoid the challenges of the paradox, I think is foolish, right? I just don't think there's any way, sustainable way, or any way to do this that doesn't actually undercut what makes democracy democracy, which is a truly open space in which people can express themselves however they want, right? I just don't know. I don't think you can tamp that down without also rendering democracy undemocratic. And that is simply too high a price. Maybe somebody smarter than me has, you know, some fix here, but brother, I don't have it. I really don't. I really don't.
I love the question because it allows me to nerd out, I suppose, a little bit about the press clause, which are forgotten press clause of our First Amendment. And so, I mean, it's the laws out of Texas and Florida. I mean, I think the idea, I mean, these tech companies, they're ultimately, they're publishing and broadcasting things. I mean, specifically publishing. And I think that distinction between platform and publisher is sometimes a little silly. I'm not sure how that truly became a thing. But I guess part of it is, I mean, and they have powerful networks that they've created, but they rise in fall to a certain extent, and their influence certainly, whereas Facebook helped, I think, the Obama presidential campaign in 2012, we saw how Facebook and all the boomers being on there helped the Trump campaign in 2016. And I think there is a way in terms of if, you know, the fact that the much of the ad tech that these companies use are based on surveillance and data. There's no like First Amendment right to like spy on people's data. So if the government wanted, they could regulate that, which might help their part. But in terms of discourse, one thing social networking has allowed, and I always think that that's sometimes a better term for it, is it has allowed people to create their own discourses and groups and network among themselves. And in some ways you get QAnon, but in other ways you get the rise of more maybe productive social organizations and social movements.
Right. And it's also allowed very powerful entrenched interest and forces to manipulate people who use those platforms in ways that is not always apparent to the people being manipulated. Right. And, you know, this is really thorny, complicated territory. And I don't think anyone has any idea what to do about it. We are in the middle of a transition, and it is upending our politics and really our culture. That is the only thing that is apparent. What to do about it is anything but.
So the book ends on this very interesting philosophical note in which you advocate for an kind of existential understanding of democracy. And I want to first start by asking you, Sean, because I suspect you may have been the driving force behind that portion of the book. What do you mean by that? What does it mean to take an existentialist orientation to the paradox of democracy?
The point is to say that democracy is something that has to be continually re-achieved by the citizens that make it up through their engaged choices and actions, right? On our reading of democracy, democracy is a kind of blank slate. It is an open field, a permanent possibility. It is a decision to play a perpetual iterative game. But that game is also defined by a tragic ambiguity, right? It allows for its own destruction. Because it is open and free, it can and does and will unleash forces that will destroy it, right? And so that makes it an existential burden for everyone who inherits it, in the sense that the openness and the freedom that defines democracy, because of that openness and that freedom, runs on a kind of honor system. I think that's the way we put it in the book, right? Nothing is ethically secured. Nothing is guaranteed. Your democracy can tumble in the direction of dictatorship or liberalism, right? And ultimately that comes down to the citizens, right? And what they're persuaded to believe or do or not. And that's why choice is always going to be, you know, the thing about existentialism is it just simply says, hey, look, you know, identity is not fixed, right? There is no essence, right? This is, we are simply what we choose to be. And democracy is what the people who make it up choose, right? Collectively. And that's a mess. It's a total mess, but that is fundamentally the condition. And that's sort of where I was coming from with trying to see it through that lens.
Yeah. I mean, I think life is absurd as an existentialist standpoint, and democracy is kind of absurd as we've discovered, but that doesn't mean you sort of throw away the cup. It's that because it's kind of absurd is that you have to commit that you're responsible. And I think there is, you know, we have a great deal of admiration for the courage of those who've been, you know, persistent in trying to mobilize and continually, you know, have faith in democracy over a period. I mean, you think about over 200 years of American democracy and how some groups have been so poorly treated, yet the commitment to try to improve and make changes and, you know, is something that democracy permits that other systems do not. But it's never perfect, and you're never dealing with perfect resources. And those imperfect resources of communication we deal with require our existentialist commitments.
Yeah, I mean, that's why we sort of begin and end the book with, you know, returning to Camus and Sisyphus, you know, democracy as that unwieldy boulder that is constantly suspended, really, you know, between the peak and the valley, right? And, you know, if you stop pushing, it will tumble over you. And that is the way of fascism. That is the way of autocracy. But whether or not it goes that way is ultimately up to the public and whether or not they're able to avoid, resist, whatever word you want to use, the temptations of the bad faith, anti-democratic actors who are exploiting the open society in which they live. And we are unfortunate in that we live in a world now where the ability of that bad faith actors to exploit democracy has never been greater. And because it's so new and so fragmented, we haven't really figured out how to deal with it. I'm not sure that we can, but that is what makes democracy, I think, an existential struggle.
Do you view it as a tragic story or an optimistic story? And I ask because, you know, we've talked about the myth of Sisyphus in this conversation. You mentioned it a lot in your book. So I went and I reread it in preparation for this interview. And it's an amazing essay. It can read quite depressingly, as many existentialists can. And then you get to the last two sentences, which are really amazing because suddenly Camus kind of pulls up and he says this: "The struggle itself toward the heights is enough to fill a man's heart. One must imagine Sisyphus happy." And that's how the essay ends. And so I wonder, in a way, I mean, the story you tell is in some ways a very dispiriting one, but it's also a heroic and optimistic one because each of us gets to fight for democracy. And even if we might lose, even if the boulder might fall down, like, what else can we do? I mean, are you happy, you too, in this fight, even though you recognize that the whole project is in some deep sense absurd?
I think a lot turns on how you choose to see it. I mean, look, it's a miracle that democracy exists at all. It really is. It's not baked into the cosmos, right? Like the democracy did not have to become a thing, right? Human beings invented it. And that's a damn miracle. And we are lucky to have inherited that project. But now the boulder falls to us. Is it tragic? Yeah, maybe. But it's also heroic, right? And I'm sympathetic to the idea that the struggle is the point, right? That's what life is, right? Eventually the lights go out, right? And whether or not your life felt meaningful to you or whether or not your democracy survives is a question of what you did or didn't do or what other people did or didn't do, whether they took action or they didn't, whether they retreated into quietism or, you know, started pushing. But I think it's both tragic and beautiful, right? Which is kind of what life is.
I mean, we're sort of just hoping for clear eyes about this in some ways, because at some point to live in a democracy is to be disappointed. An election will go against you. A Supreme Court decision will go against you. And yet, I mean, you can storm the Capitol, or you can acknowledge that that's sort of what happened, and yet you still live in that society, and that change is down the road. Because I think a lot, whether it's these big important questions about the environment or individual rights, or even just like infrastructure, these things, these are all 30 to 50 year projects. But we always know the next election is never too far away. So there's the near term, long term, but there's hope, I think, in that, which I think is exciting. And I think as the sort of liberal democracy papered over some of these contradictions, I think our book, and why I think Sean and I are at least somewhat optimistic, even if we find it a little absurd, is that now this is the real game is afoot here, because this is democracy as such. And so there's something exciting about that. There's an opportunity there, but we don't know if those opportunities are going to be taken or squandered, because that's democracy.
Yeah. You know, I guess the last thing I would say is that, you know, one thing that the age of liberal democracy allowed us to do was take it for granted, right? The world just felt like it was on firm ground, and it felt like the game was just going to keep going and going and going. And I think we have learned that that's actually not the case, that it was always contingent. And I think that's more apparent now. And hopefully that's an impetus to get off the bench and start pushing. And if it isn't, then the democracy that we have won't last. It just won't, you know? And I think that's the case.
Well, I think we should end on what I'm going to decide is a hopeful note. Zach, Sean, thank you very, very much for coming and talking about your excellent book, The Paradox of Democracy. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
This is fun. Thanks for having us on.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. You can get ad-free versions of this and other Lawfare podcasts by becoming a Lawfare material supporter at patreon.com/lawfare. You'll also get access to special events and other content available only to our supporters. Please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. Look out for our other podcasts, including Rational Security, Chatter, and our latest Lawfare Presents podcast series on the government's response to January 6th, the aftermath. Check out our written work at lawfareblog.com, and you can buy Lawfare swag at thelawfarestore.com. The podcast is edited by Jen Patya-Howell, and your audio engineer this episode was Kara Schillen of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thank you for listening.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.